36, May the 2nd, 2010. And this week, as long as myself, Croc Cayman, and Tom Howard are regular hosts, we are joined by Tess Flynn.
Hello.
Who has been on the show numerous times before. Thank you for joining us again, Tess.
It's not a problem.
Okay. Apologies, everyone, for audio echo if you are getting it. Ever since Tom has switched to Linux, we've had this echo problem and have not been able to track it down.
See, I'm also on Linux right now, and I'm not sure if I'm causing that problem either.
Not at all.
It's just kind of a weird thing, right? I have no idea what it is. Oh, well, who cares?
Well, I wonder if it's the Pulse Audio implementation from the Debian fork, but I could be wrong.
What distro are you on, Tess?
Arch. I'm actually a version behind on Arch because I've had such a hellish month that I haven't had the guts to actually try to run Pac-Man SY on my system.
Not facing up to the break.
It really be problematic.
Okay, and this week we're hopefully wanting to discuss not mobile computing itself, actually the opposite of mobile computing. We've done a show specializing in mobile computing before, and I wanted to focus on basically desktop computing in lieu of all this mobile computing hype that is going around at the moment, that manufacturers are very quick to embrace, you know, all the wonders that mobile computing presents, etc. But the reality is that the world is still, you know, working on the backbone of desktop computing, and it forms the absolute mainstay of computing at this period.
In the consumer space.
Well, what do you mean outside of the consumer space, that they wouldn't be using desktop computing as the primary form of computing?
Well, I'm being a little bit pedantic here, because when you see primary form of computing, I'm thinking about the amount of transactions might occur in the average data center, and I'm thinking, yeah, there's probably a lot more in racks of servers and mainframes than ever go through desktops, but I'm being pedantic, I admit it.
Yes,
please don't yell at me.
It's still desktop architecture. It's not they're not going through iPads and things like that, are they? It's
No.
Can you imagine iPad as a server?
Imagine a Beowulf cluster of iPads.
I mean, I was in Houston last week, and I think I might have seen an iPad, because there was a bunch of people from Europe and Germany and all over the place, and they were all buying iPads while they were in the U.S. because they can't get them yet over there.
Actually, they make a pretty bad cluster, considering that they can't talk to each other and they're completely closed devices.
I'll break them open.
Jailbreak them. Right, whereabouts should we start with this? I'm not even sure.
It's your idea. I'm giving you full authority to start somewhere.
Okay. Think. Stall.
Unicorn. Sorry.
I can edit this.
I'm trying not to remember I'm trying not to remember the Grandpa Simpson line about having an onion on his belt, which was the style at the time.
Yeah, there's a story to this coin, and then he goes on about onions on belts. Sorry, this week's so crazy news-wise. It's driven me off topic.
If we had a tech cloud for this week, there'd be like only one, like 264. And it would feel like the entire cloud.
No, if we had a tag cloud, it would be H264, H.264, and then all a million different spellings of the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Which is the problem with tagging.
Because I used the one, because I used the one with the capital H, with the uppercase H, and no period in between. But other people used the dot whatever. And the other people use like lowercase or, you know, lowercase without the dot, whatever. It's, all sorts of combinations are possible. A few misspellings, obviously. I mean, it's pretty clear. So, yeah, we've had a week that is...
Yeah. I suppose the first question that comes to mind is, with the whole tablet computing, mobile computing versus traditional desktop computing question is, it goes back down to what can't you do on a tablet system that you can do far more effectively on a desktop?
Well, there's a lot of things go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I would turn that question around. What can you do on a tablet that you cannot do on either a desktop or a laptop? Which kind of I kind of mean with desktop the same thing as a laptop, like a traditional computer. I would like to turn the question around because I still haven't gotten an answer to that one. Everybody's raving about the iPad, but I still don't know what it does that I cannot do on any other device, or any tablet. But it doesn't matter. Just I'm taking the iPad as a reference here because it's so successful. But
I know one thing that I've always tended to prefer mobile devices for over any desktop client I've tried is really any real-time social networking sites such as Twitter. I've just never liked Twitter apps that I get on the desktop. I love them on mobile devices, though. I don't know what it is, if it's the UI, if it's the use pattern that just tends to work more for a Twitter-type interaction. But I've never really liked Twitter clients on desktops. It just, I don't know what it is. It just doesn't seem to work for me.
Maybe because, like, when you're sitting behind a desktop or a laptop, that you're maybe, like, at work or working on something serious, and Twitter doesn't really fit in there. Maybe that's the... when you're like, sitting on the couch or whatever with your phone.
I'm in front of computers 18 hours a day.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to...
Well, perhaps the answer to your question, Tom, it boils down to device specialization. I mean, somebody's written a Twitter client for an Apple II, and I was going to say that, well, you could do anything on a VAX that you could do now. It just would be, you know, different and slow. So it's not that the tablet cannot do anything that the desktop can't, because by nature, computer systems, because they're Turing machines, can do anything that any other computer can do, just less practical. And so I don't think it would definitely be hard to find an example.
So let me rephrase that question then. What can a tablet do better than a traditional desktop / laptop? And to that question, I don't have an answer either. Because whatever you're going to say, it's going to be more cumbersome than just using a mouse or whatever. I just don't really get it because it...
I can think of one thing that they're actually... particularly good at least with my use pattern, which is the modern equivalent of reading the newspaper in the morning, checking my RSS feeds. I tend to like having a mobile device versus a desktop for that, because I can page through it a lot more friendly. Also, the simple fact of if you want to like lay on the floor, because I'm in a tiny little apartment because I'm poor, and it's hard on the neck and the back to actually lay on the floor and use like a laptop, whereas a tablet or a mobile device, you can just lay it flat on the floor and it doesn't cause as many ergonomic problems. But that's very particular to how I interact with devices.
I have to interrupt everybody for a second, because I just got to say, if there are any Dutch listeners in here, FC Twente just became champion. Woohoo! Sorry. I just have to say that. Go on.
Isn't it going to be really a bit late by the time they get this here. Podcast?
Yeah, I know. Oh, I don't care. Oh, the fans are crying. Oh, okay. Anyway.
Spoiler alert. Those were saving the match for later and thought, I don't know, I'll just go listen to the OS News podcast, or I'll be completely away from football.
Yeah, you should probably publish this one tomorrow on Monday. That's tonight.
There's also the paradigm problem of that there are things that that are going to be inherently less difficult to do on a tablet that's user interface wise, but then things that you just that are going to be harder to do on a sort of tablet and mobile device. And I think the biggest sort of bottleneck really is programming, is trying to do any sense of kind of just content creation in general on a mobile device.
Yeah, that's kind of the point, because people say, well, reading the web, but how many people just read the web these days? Isn't the web all about participation? Even if you find an article where there's no comment section, what a lot of people will do is put it on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So you're going to need at some point like typing and whatever. And why would you limit yourself with something like an on-screen keyboard, because people can say that typing on the iPad is easy, but I don't believe them. I don't believe them. I mean, it can never be as easy as just having a proper keyboard around. And when you want to plug in a keyboard, why not just use a laptop right away? Isn't that like easier? Or am I just really old-fashioned or something? I just don't get it.
I think that one thing that's important to keep in mind is the kind of interaction that you would typically do versus a vast majority of a lot of other people. I mean, you're a journalist, and I'm a content creator myself, and we spend a lot more time making stuff, but there's a lot of people that a quick interaction with an on-screen keyboard is perfectly suitable because they don't need to spend a lot of time writing out long things when the average comment or blog post is not going to be more than 1,000 words.
The average YouTube comment is going to not be more than a sentence.
And will majorly consist of four-letter words. At least in English.
Fit that description.
Yeah, well, one other thing, I think that probably the biggest letdown of the iPad, the biggest failing of it, and I've kept my discussion of the iPad to an absolute bare minimum, considering I have not yet had my hands on one and want to reserve any kind of review until such a time, because I don't even know what the price is going to be in the UK. They haven't even so much as revealed that yet. But my biggest concern of it is not what hard features it's missing. I haven't got a clue about it. I don't care what software features it's missing. It's all things that can be solved, or if they're not solved, doesn't matter, because what features it does have will suit the particular people who need said features. They can only increase their market by adding features, right? The biggest problem is that the device cannot operate on its own. It cannot be your only computer. It seems to be a massive failing, I think, on the part of this computer that's supposed to be designed for average people to finally get ahead and be successful with computing by having something that's easy and that they can touch and they don't have to read the manual beforehand. And at the same time, you have to plug it into a computer and go through iTunes to get it registered and started. And this seems like a terrible limitation.
But that's particular to Apple products. There are other tablets that are being developed and will be arriving on the market, especially in India lately, where you see a lot of Android tablet action going on lately that don't require it to be tethered to any kind of local computing source.
Yeah, I think that's going to make a huge difference, that you'll be able to get something like this and for some people it be their primary source of computing and not have to be tied down to a desktop either, because for a majority they use the internet for their particular services. They want their Facebook, their eBay and their Amazon and so forth, and if the interactions are simple enough, then a tablet device should be able to solve everything they do, or at least a large enough portion for their own personal use and anything else they could fill in, say with work computers at work or their friend's computer or the library, or something like that. So I certainly think the market actually exists, as long as the hardware and the software is going to be good enough and the availability is going to be good of these devices. And so as far as the desktop computer is concerned, it wouldn't threaten that really. It's just down to particular users and their usage of, the type of usage they have on the computer.
That is a very good point. Actually, I thought about this while I was in the hotel this week, because there are several days that my laptop sat on the desk asleep while I was using my phone to go through and read my feeds and browse the internet and such, and I just didn't need to open my laptop because I didn't have anything more in mind for that evening. But as soon as I got to any large amount of typing or content creation or anything more heavy than what I could do on the mobile device, I went right to the laptop.
Well, I fixed computers. Sorry, Tom.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a similar, because my netbook's charger was broken, so I hadn't been able, and I hadn't tested it yet, so I didn't know it was the charger. I thought the laptop itself was broken because the charger was new, but it turns out that the charger was at least the connector is broken. But so I wasn't able to use my netbook for like a couple of months now, and this weekend I fixed it, or at least I got another charger that did work. So I borrowed it from someone, so I can order a new one now. And as soon as I got my netbook back, I was so happy, because I wouldn't have to use my iPhone anymore to do my browsing when I go to bed. I usually browse a little bit before I go to sleep and when I wake up in the morning. So I'm really happy to have my netbook back because at least I can have a decent browsing experience, because as fun as the iPhone is and as good as the browsing experience is compared to other mobile phones, I mean, given the choice, I mean, it's easy. I'm going to have my laptop with me or my netbook in this case. I'm not going to use the iPhone when I have something else standing by. So I just don't really understand that, why you would choose to use your iPhone or on any other phone, whatever, if you've got a decent laptop around, in my case, a netbook. I just don't.
I think it's
a no-brainer.
I think in my case, it's a little bit specific because the social networks and the websites that I interacted with I have relatively good clients outside of the browser for that. And that does tend to make the experience a lot better than going to the actual website. In some cases, there's less clutter. It's more directed towards functionality. It's faster than what I would have to get from the whole onslaught that I would get from the actual full desktop experience.
That's really interesting because I think it's fun that we've so far been discussing the websites and not having mentioned operating systems at all in all of this. And that's, as I was going to say, I fix computers for a living and I'm seeing what the average user is doing with their computer. And whilst skill sets vary, you get to sort of a professional curve where you get people up to a certain level and then they know what they're doing and they will go and explore Windows and put it to use. But for the majority of people, it's just a glorified internet box. They literally, most people's computers are beyond overpowered for what they need to use them for. And it's just sort of a glorified internet box that is way overcomplicated because of Windows. So the idea that they can have something that's just going to be browsing is excellent. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a tablet, because I think that if we could get round to finally getting sort of 15-inch ARM laptops with keyboard, very thin, no fans, and just have like an operating system like Chrome OS on it, that would actually be just as good, if not better, than sort of all this tablet hype.
Dead silence. I don't really like this whole. You see a lot of geeks do that, and you're probably a little bit more entitled to say that because of your job. But I really dislike this idea of most users only do this and that. I just don't trust those kinds of statements. It's like saying most people only drive on this road or something. I just don't really buy it, because there will be a moment where they'll need to be able to do something that such a limited device like the iPad or any other tablet cannot do, right? And when at that point, when a laptop is just as expensive, I mean, I just don't really get why you would want to go for a tablet, which will at some point give you headaches, because there's always something you can't do. Like right now, you can't use it for Skype. You can't really use it. People say you can use it for content creation, like document stuff, but you can't. And a lot of people still do, have to create Word documents, maybe type a letter for the government or whatever, or for the job, or, you know, and you can't do that with just the tablet. And again, I just don't understand why, if you already have a laptop, why you would buy yet another device that sits somewhere in between, you know, a truly mobile device like a phone and your laptop. Again, maybe I'm just old-fashioned. I mean, the iPad is selling really, really well. But is it selling really, really well right now because it's new and it's ooh and shiny and ooh and ah? But will people still be using it a couple of weeks down the line? Right?
Well, have we really gotten a good market breakdown of the kind of usage patterns that the purchasers of the iPad are actually having? Without that data, we're all just kind of guessing.
It's all geeks for the moment. Yeah. It'll take two years before we get mainstream data for this sort of thing.
Because I've been asking some of my non-geek and lesser geek friends about this sort of stuff all week, and a lot of them just don't get it. I mean, they can see the idea of having a more powerful smartphone to do casual browsing or site interaction or the occasional casual game, but they don't really see any of these devices just replacing their desktop. It just doesn't seem to work for them in that capacity. I just don't think that they're there yet.
Computer, regular consumers, your majority, it's not that they're stupid that they don't do so much on their computer. It's down to interface. They would use every bit of its power if it were simple enough to do so, because for the majority of people, the computer is a tool that they want to put to use for their life. They want Skype not because they want Skype, they want Skype because they want to talk to their family in Australia or whatever like that. It has to fit into their life in some way. And that's where the desktop has kind of failed them, is that it's a overpowered workstation that can just do absolutely everything under the sun, but doesn't do anything specific easily and doesn't present that to them in an obvious way, whereas I think the iPad does present to them what it can do, even though it can't do everything. What it can do, it presents it in an obvious way. And therefore, they can put something like that to more of a use than what they can a desktop computer, unless they put themselves out to actually learn, a lot about it.
But is that a UI issue, or is that really a form factor issue? It seems to be, to me, more like a UI issue.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's why I think Windows is a failure here.
No, it doesn't have to.
Well,
let's not just pick on
Windows here. I'll more than quickly pick on all the major desktop environments that connects on this too.
Yeah, we could call them.
Yeah, macOS 10. People scream how different it is, but it's exactly the same as.
It's just basically
silly. But
menus at the top of the screen, not on the window.
It's still a Wim. Yeah. We've got a desktop metaphor. That's the one. A desktop metaphor.
So a couple of months ago, my parents asked me that they wanted. I have two media centers in my home, like one in the living room, one in the bedroom, where I store all my TV shows and a couple of movies that I download, which is legal in this country. Yay! So that way I can view television series, because usually the series that I watch haven't arrived yet in the Netherlands, and they're only in America and maybe the UK. But it usually takes a couple of years for stuff to get here. So my parents asked me, they said, I want something, we want that too. And I was like, well, okay, that's good. Give me money and I'll build you a computer that can do that and give you the same software that I have, which is Booksy. And, and a lot of people would think, well, my parents aren't especially computer savvy. They can use a computer, but it's not, they're the kind of people that Croc would probably be helping on average, right? So they're not stupid, but they're not particularly computer savvy either. And you would think that, if you listen to all the talk, a lot of things that geeks say, like how complicated computers are and how stupid people are, that they would never be able to use such a device. But, I did something extremely revolutionary when I gave them that computer. I just took a couple of hours out of my extremely busy schedule, and I just, did something really revolutionary. I told them how it worked. I just said this, and you listen to this, and I made sure that that machine that I built, that media center, has a little icon on their desktop so that they can move stuff there. So my parents, I taught them in a couple of hours. I taught them how to use BitTorrent to download movies and series. I taught them how to copy it from their respective own computers, my mom's laptop and my dad's iMac, how to copy that to the media center and how to operate the media center in a couple of hours. Sometimes people have this idea that a computer should be so easy to just sit down that everything works, but give me any really complicated device that can do that. None of them can. Even the iPhone takes a lot of learning and a lot of getting used to before people are able to use it. I've seen it with my mother. I've seen it with myself, actually. I had a lot of trouble in the beginning with the iPhone. My dad bought a new iPhone a couple of months ago. By now, it's also problematic in the beginning. It's not easy. It's not easy at all. And sometimes you just have to help people along. When I turned 18 and I was allowed to drive a car, I didn't know right away how to drive it. Learning to operate the car is easy, but actually driving takes a lot of practice. You need some lessons, and even when you pass the driving test, there's still months and years of learning that follow, when you're actually out on the road and you go to Amsterdam for the first time, where it's really busy and crowded and everything. It's all just a learning process, and somehow we accept that it takes learning to drive a car, that it takes learning to get to a new job or whatever, or to learn a sport or whatever. But when it comes to a computer, somehow everything has to be so easy that you can know it, with the flick of the wrist. But it just doesn't work that way. Sometimes you have to take people who are not, really computer savvy. You just have to take them. You have to sit down and you have to teach them how it works. And even if that's only a couple of hours, I did that, and I don't get any questions anymore from my parents about how that media center worked. Just because right off the bat, I took a couple of hours, maybe 2-3 hours, and taught them how everything works. And they know it. Sometimes, and it's a Windows machine, right? So it's Windows 7 with Boxy. So it's not like it's some sort of magical device that I dumped down for them. It's a full-on normal computer. But just by setting things up properly and teaching them a couple of basics, they know exactly how it works. So
true,
you know,
but you had to set
time.
It up. I mean, could they have set that up on their own? You've got those unnecessary hurdles, I would call them, in computing. Great. So
yeah,
it's great when you can get on and use it and put it to use. Totally. And yes, they need to be, you need to learn that sort of thing. But I've always found that trying to explain things to consumers and to trying to teach them, there's so many really unnecessarily, needlessly complicated, pointless bits of computing that just get in the way of actually teaching them something useful. Like trying to explain the differences between formats and why one company will not cooperate with another. And you can't get, this thing to talk to another thing because of just, just the insanity of the computer market.
Yeah, but that also depends on how you on what kind of software you get people, because when you learn to drive a car, you don't learn how to drive a car in a Ferrari. You learn to drive a car in preferably, at least here in Europe, at least in the Netherlands, it's normal to learn how to drive in a diesel powered car, because they're much easier to operate and aren't as quirky and explosive between quotation marks as a petrol car is. They have a slightly slower acceleration curve usually, so it's easier to learn how to drive those things. So when you learn how to drive, you take something easy. A diesel car, preferably a saloon, because it's
slightly... But if the computer world was like that, then we would have roads that could only take Sony cars and roads that could only take Apple cars, and it would be infinitely more pointlessly complicated than something as simple as just petrol and diesel. That's the unfortunate of it. I would like it to be simpler to people
no
could put it to use.
Well,
yeah. Sorry,
I have no formal problems for the Media Center, because on Windows there's this incredibly awesome package called the codec pack, which you just install, and you install the everything version, and you get like 10 million codecs, and you'll never encounter any format that you cannot play. And it's all DirectShow and Media Foundation, so it's playable throughout the entire machine. So of course, those are things that you need to know, but it's the same when you go and buy a car. Someone who's never bought a car before cannot buy a car. Even if you've bought 3 cars, you're not a car person, you've already bought cars before, it's going to be really complicated to buy one. There are so many things you have to take into account that you have no idea about, like, what is this, what is that, why do I need that, why do I not need that? And it's the same thing with a computer. I mean, sometimes things just take time to learn. And some things are complicated by definition, and just, removing features or taking features away is not solving a problem. In the same way that virtual directory structures, like you see these days on Linux, you're starting to see it, and you see it on Mac OS X, that does not solve the problem of the fact that files are complicated or that the file system is complicated, right? It just hides it. And hiding or removing is not solving problems. It's just hiding or removing, basically.
I do have to point out that there is one angle to this that we're kind of ignoring, and I know I'm going to get yelled at for this, which is that there is a bit of a casual elitism amongst the in-no computing set, that the attitude that, well, if you can't figure it out, why should I spend my time on you? And I've always found that attitude very, very destructive and a bit snobbish. And as a computer trainer, I've noticed many, many times that there's a lot of people out there who are just too nervous to even ask questions because they don't want to appear ignorant. And some of these people are guys who work in the computer industry with some very high-powered stuff, and they don't want to ask someone like me a question because they're afraid of looking like they don't know what they're doing. And I think that's a lot more common in the consumer set. And I don't think that a lot of people who tend to be really good with computers want to take the time to teach people these things, because teaching people is hard, and computers tend to attract a not-so-social set of individuals.
Yeah, well, that'd be a really good point.
Guilty as charged as well.
Well, I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant or anything, but I kind of like I like computers, but I also like teaching other people how stuff works. And I even teach a lot of people who have no interest in computers. I even teach them a lot of technical stuff about, you know, I don't have any examples right now, but I like that. I like to, you know, think about something complicated in computing and then make it easy for people to understand. I kind of like doing that. I mean, which is kind of weird when you think about it, because I don't really like teachers in general. I've, you know, I have my share of fights with teachers. But anyway, it's kind of, I'm still kind of good at that. Maybe that's why I have no problems with teaching some of my computer literate friends or my parents, you know, how computers work. And that maybe it's a special ability or something to be able to take something complicated like computing and make it understandable. I mean, maybe I'm slightly more unique in that sense than some of the readers we have, for instance, who might be more of the traditional geek type and, you know, with basements and Warhammer figurines and that sort of stuff. But I'm not entirely sure.
Well, teaching people is hard, too.
It's, yeah. It
requires a lot of effort and a lot of trying to look inside someone else's mental process to figure out how they understand things and trying to draw parallels so that they can internalize what you're trying to teach them. And it can be very difficult at times. And sometimes it's very, very frustrating. And I'm not sure if a lot of people who are very good at computers really spend enough time on knowing how to make those bridge those gaps.
Hmm.
This is one of the things.
It could also help that.
Sorry.
No, it could also be that maybe I don't have geek friends. I have normal friends. If you allow me to use the word normal and feel I'm here, but. I don't have any geek friends, like zero, like absolutely none. All my friends are what you would call, again, quotation mark, regular people who use computers but don't really, you know, have any special interest in them or whatever. So maybe that kind of helped me in being better able to appreciate how it is to not be a complete computer whiz. And maybe that makes it easier for me to deal with other people who, you know, aren't particularly computer savvy, because whenever I do meet someone in the real world who is computer savvy, I generally don't really get along. So maybe that's kind of related to that, but makes it easier for me to teach other people to use computers. I don't know. Could definitely be. But you're right in that it's there's a lot of arrogance among geeks that people just don't seem geeks don't seem to be able to understand that computers can be difficult and that sometimes you need to take a few deep breaths, and sometimes you need to be patient with people. But you know, and it's the same way the other way around. I mean, when I learned how to drive, I mean, it wasn't like a snap. I mean, I can drive really well now, but it also took me slightly longer than average to learn how to drive properly. So you know, and my teacher also had to be patient and learn me how everything works. So sometimes you really do need to be patient, and I think a lot of geeks don't have patience.
I'd like to say I think that also geeks have to learn that and come to accept that computers can be easy too. And this is why the iPad and a lot of this computing stuff riles up geeks so much, is because they can't accept that something can be easy and that that you can develop a machine that isn't a general purpose thing for tinkering and that can be, you know, repurposed to do anything, and that we are so hung up on what it cannot do, we are failing to recognize what it is capable of.
Well, I think the bigger problem there is that there is no reason for such a device not to be able to do that. I think the bigger problem with why we are so angry with devices like the iPhone and the iPad is not because of the fact that it cannot do stuff, but the fact that Apple is actively trying to prevent us from doing it. If Apple were to turn a blind eye to that and just would just allow it, but just, you know, like revoke a guarantee or revoke warranty or something, which is perfectly acceptable in my book, I don't think that at that point there would have been that much problems with that. If they said, well, hey, if you use the App Store, you have full warranty and guarantee and everything, but as soon as you move outside of the App Store, you lose your warranty and it's over. I think if they did that, that wouldn't have been such a backlash. Like,
why are we so hung up on that? Because if you think of everything else you own in life, like television, your car, every material product I own is neither open nor, you know...
No. You're making the same mistake here. Your car might not be open, but Opel or Ford is not going to prevent you from working on your car. And I think that's the big difference. When I have a Focus, if I want to change something on that car, even a new engine, I can do whatever I want. I can I can fiddle with the chips that control the fuel injection and everything. Ford isn't going to stop me, isn't going to sue me, isn't going to make it illegal for me to do so, and whatever. And Apple is actively trying to prevent that. And probably because Apple is successful, other companies will follow. So, you know, I think it's the actively trying to prevent bit that really riles people up. Not necessarily the fact that that the iPad isn't designed to do stuff, but that it's that Apple's trying to prevent you from doing said stuff. I think that's the bigger problem than actually not being able to do stuff, if that makes any sense.
And so the average consumer, they don't see it as us. We've grown up knowing and being used to a device for us to tinker with, and it would be no different than those who grew up with cars when they were young and were used to, you know, being under the bonnet and everything. And, but for the consumer, these devices do not have to have these capabilities. They are it's a consumable device for consuming content, and much the same as their television. They do not think that it odd to be that they cannot run anything they want on their television's operating system, or also such with their cars. They can install anything they want with their cars. So this idea of a non-general purpose computer, a specialized device, is riling geeks up, and because we know it's got a processor in it, we know it's got software in it, we assume that therefore that means it must be open.
Yeah, well, no, no. It's not that it must be open, it's just that we don't like it when companies prevent us from doing something without any good reason.
I'm simply asking for name a parallel. Name anything else we have that is given to us from a company in which they are not vested in protecting their interests, and say, here you go, here's the circuit diagram that comes with it, and you know, you can go tinker with this.
Again, it's not that geeks are angry that they cannot do it, or that Apple doesn't help them doing it, but that Apple is actively trying to prevent us from doing it. It's the preventing bit, the actively preventing bit, that is at least what makes me angry. Not the fact that it can't do anything. I mean, I don't care that my iPhone can't do some stuff that, you know, other phones are able to do, but the fact that, you know, that Apple is preventing me from doing it.
Well, right? Don't we have DRM in televisions with HDMI and DRM in our Blu-ray players and you know, DRM up the wahoo?
Yeah, but that riles us up just as much, doesn't it? I mean, there's enough opposition against... There's just the same amount of opposition against DRM as there is against Apple's policies regarding the iPhone and the iPad. Mm. So it confirms my example, right? It confirms my little theory.
Moving on. Let's say, what does this present to the desktop? You know, there was an iOS News article about Steve Jobs saying that, no, the Apple App Store way of doing things would not come to Mac OS X. Is there a future where we can see that the App Store way of doing things, this very locked down thing that we are complaining about so much with the iPhone and iPad, is it ever going to come to a desktop operating system near us?
I'm not sure if that's necessarily the question to ask. I know that recently the Worldwide Developer Conference was announced for Apple, and they're not accepting any Mac applications. I think that the bigger question to ask here is, are we looking at a future where the desktop is going to be displaced by these much more locked down devices, and we simply won't have the option anymore because the desktops will no longer be in demand and cost so much more money that will be priced out of the market?
I don't think so, because we've been hearing the end of the desktop in whatever form for 20 years now.
Well, that's true.
I mean, Sun was really big on this whole, on having thin clients and all that stuff, and it didn't happen. I mean, the demise of the petrol car, that sort of thing. I mean, it's not going to happen. I don't believe that the desktop is going to go away anytime soon, and especially not because this whole internet thing. I don't use the word cloud, as some of you might know. This whole internet thing just isn't mature enough. I mean, here in the Netherlands, we have really fast internet, but you know, there are a lot of places, even in the U.S., that don't have the internet to support many of those modern devices that rely always on internet connection. And even here in Europe, a lot of locations don't have it. So it's going to take at least 20 years for internet to be fast and pervasive around the world before we can even think about moving away from more stationary objects like desktops and laptops and things like that.
Well, probably longer at the U.S.
Yeah, but more in a general way. But no, I mean, the desktop isn't going away anytime soon. Forget it. It's and with desktop, I also mean like the traditional laptop. It's not going away. anytime soon. I don't believe.
But that focuses on the demand question, and as we can tell with, I hate to say that Apple might not necessarily be as concerned with demand as some other companies might be. What if we are simply not given the choice any longer because no one's producing it? That's the scary future for me.
Yeah, that's really scary. Yeah, I have to agree.
Well, this is going to the iPad not being a device that can operate on its own. You can't program on the iPad. You need to buy a Mac and to be able to program on it, and then you also need to pay Apple every year to be able to access your own device and to put code onto it. So that presents an interesting side of the desktop, which is that the desktop computer is for engineers only, and Apple want the iPad for consumers in the long run, and the desktop will be the workstation for the people who need to get, in inverted commas, serious work done.
Yeah, that is a future that's actually quite possible. Yeah. There is, I have to point out to our listeners that there is a serious delay here, so that's why we're stepping on each other.
Okay.
I
don't really have anything to add at this point. Hello? Is everybody still here or what?
Yes.
Yeah, we just don't have anything else to add.
No, neither do I. How long have we been talking? 45 minutes? Holy crap.
Oh, wow, really?
Can I say crap? Yeah, I can say crap. Okay.
Yes.
Good. Should we say anything about the H word or the H number?
Well, we already have, unfortunately, at the start, but we haven't actually discussed the news of it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah, we did. We did say something about 264. That's true. It kind of. I told Croc yesterday that I kind of noted that OS News is kind of turning into the central location for people against H.264, because if you go to a lot of other websites, even sites like Ars Technica and even the BBC, for God's sake, are kind of pointing to various OS News articles as the other side of the H.264 debate, which is kind of...
That is weird.
The Slashdot article was particularly strange.
The
Slashdot article about Internet Explorer 9 going for H.264 only spun it as, this is a good thing because IE9 is embracing HTML5. Didn't really say anything about the fact that it was H.264 only, and therefore that was a bad thing for Linux. Even I would expect them to have brought up Linux in the sentence, considering this was Slashdot, but they didn't. It was really weird.
Yeah,
I keep looking at that whole IE9 H.264 thing, and I keep thinking, Microsoft is making this decision like a company, because companies only trust other companies as far as their lawyers go. In this case, Microsoft is trusting the MPEG LA as far as their hordes of lawyers go. If from that kind of mindset, something that is a quote unencumbered format like Ogg Vorbis, Theora, sorry, is scary, because you don't know. You could get sued left and right from things, but if you pay the license, you're good. It's a corporate mindset. And unfortunately, there's a lot less corporations than people out there, but unfortunately.
Yeah, but one of the core things, of course, here, and that kind of explains everything, follow the money, because Microsoft is part of the MPEG LA and it's part of the patent pool behind H.264. So the choice for Microsoft to go H.264 is obviously entirely self-serving, which is okay. I have no problem with that. They're a company. But they're using a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt to justify their position. If they would have just come out and say, look, we're going with H.264 because we think it's the best, and that would be okay. I mean, a company is a company, and they make a decision that is best for themselves and for the shareholders. That's okay. But I don't really like that they're trying to scare people away from the competing formats by saying, what exactly did they say? The kind of strange thing that they said.
Oh, they said that the other codecs, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where is it?
Other codecs often come up in these discussions. The distinction between the availability of source code and ownership of the intellectual property in that available source code is critical. Today, intellectual property rights for H.264 are broadly available through a well-defined program managed by MPEG-LA. Yeah. The rights to other codecs are often less clear, as has been described in the press. What codecs? What isn't clear? What press?
Yeah, it's probably one of the best pieces of FUD that I've ever read, because it's, you know, a lot of people reading this will think, oh, yeah, well, that's good. I mean, we have to use H.264 because Microsoft says the other codecs are legally problematic. But, I mean, we've been hearing this stuff for 10 years now, and there's never been anyone able to point out a single friggin' patent that the ownership, you know, supposedly infringes upon. So it's you know, I really dislike what's going on here. And I think Eugenia put it really well in that the MPEG-LA has been incredibly successful in setting up this entire minefield across the entirety of the digital video world, where every camera, every piece of software has a non-commercial license to use H.264, and that they've been saying for so long that it is impossible to create a codec that doesn't infringe upon one of our patents, that everybody believes them. Technically, it's incredibly ingenious what they've done. I mean, you have to admire them for it. But it's kind of really, really crippling. And this situation is probably a lot worse than the situation with Flash, because at least with Flash, you know, it's Adobe, and Adobe has never, you know, alluded to suing anyone over implementing Flash or using Flash or whatever. And they've even opened up a lot of stuff, not everything. I'm not entirely sure how far that goes with this whole open screen nonsense. But technically, compared to what the MPEG-LA has been saying and how the MPEG-LA have been acting, Adobe has been kind of a saint compared to them. I mean, Adobe hasn't been...
At the end of the day, it has always been optional. Flash is just an optional install, and you can survive without it, whereas this is dangerous because Microsoft are saying that you can only use H.264 if you're using HTML5, and Apple are saying the same thing. You can only use H.264 if you're using HTML5, and therefore you must pay the MPEG-LA, which pays into our pockets, and we think it's fine that we shouldn't have to pay for a license because we're a patent holder, but you lot should have to.
Yeah, and I was going to say something. Yeah, and as Eugenia pointed out, it's been entrenched into everything. You know, almost every camera you buy has these licenses built in, but they're restrictive variants, so you can't really do anything economic with them. So, and even software and all that stuff. And if you're using an open source implementation for in this case H.264, and you live in America, you're technically breaking the law, right? I mean, it's actually incredibly ingenious what they've done, but it's kind of it can make me pretty angry because. Not necessarily what they're doing makes me angry, because again, they're companies and they're working to make money, which is good for everybody in the end somehow. But what scares me is that a lot of people fall for this stuff and keep defending the decisions from Microsoft and Apple to stick with H.264. You know, even though you explain so clearly that it's dangerous, I mean, they just don't see it, and that kind of scares me. That really scares me that people don't see that. After all these years that we've been confronted with patent lawsuits that we all think are ridiculous, but somehow because Apple or Microsoft, it's okay, no problem. I just don't get it. It's just such a short-sighted mindset. You know, and I know that 10 years down the line, when we are confronted with patent problems regarding H.264, when the MPEG-LA finally started to...
Five
or 10 years down the line, it's going to be problematic. And all those people who are advocating H.264 now because, it's better and it's ubiquitous and all that stuff, they're going to be the same people who will blame everyone but themselves for the spreading of
The situation has become so bad, I think that the only way this is going to be solved is if it explodes in everybody's face. I would quite happily see the MPEG-LA sue every single one of us for infringing on something or other, just to bring up the utter absurdity of it. Come 2015, they will be able to extract money from essentially every single person who has ever watched a video on the internet anywhere, period.
It's going to turn into the SCO art of the whole SCO Linux debacle.
I just got a phone call. It's really crappy. And really... If there's one thing that I hope that's going to happen in the coming weeks or months, please, Google, I know you're a company too, and you're just as evil as everybody else. I don't believe that. Don't be evil nonsense. And evil is here between quotation marks. I mean, the kind of evil that Google is referring to with its motto. I know that you're kind of the same thing, but please do this whole VP8 thing that everybody's been talking about. Make it open source and switch YouTube over to VP8 in a couple of weeks and just give everybody else the Flash version and remove the H.264 versions completely. So, you know, you're going to screw a lot of iPhone owners and iPad owners, but in the end, it's only... It's less than 1% of your traffic as far it's less than 1% of your traffic on YouTube, so it wouldn't really matter. But really, a lot of this stuff is going to depend on what Google is going to do with Onto that it bought, obviously, and the VP8 codec. I'm so hoping that Google is going to come in and save the day. Basically, it's probably idle hope because again, Google is also a company and they're going to choose whatever makes the most sense for them. And at this point, H.264 makes kind of sense for them, right? I mean,
yeah, they could afford it, and they are already paying for a license to distribute Chrome with H.264,
exactly.
And they're using it mostly on YouTube and for the YouTube app on iPad and things. So this, I don't think Google are going to be very quick in this. We would all love it to be quick, but I think, to be honest, they have 5 years, and it's probably going to be by the year's end before we get anything really starting to move with this. VP8 could be possibly the solution for this, but transitioning YouTube, I don't think, is something that you can just do that quickly. It's the tools surrounding the codec that's going to be important to get correct. People need to be able to encode to it easily. They've got to add plugins. They've got to add this to the support to Chrome and Chrome Frame, and they've got to blanket everything horizontally with VP8 so that the transition is rather smooth. Because frankly, at the moment, the situation is not very smooth with Ogg Theora. I think that's probably the situation as to why Google hasn't been forthwith with adopting it.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't a lot of production tools in that sense that really take Theora into account. It's all, you know, H.264. That's basically the baseline, and anything else you usually have to use plugins. And, you know, even the plugins for QuickTime are out of date regarding Theora. They're pretty good on Windows, but they're completely out of date on the Mac. And you know, it's just the tools aren't there in that sense for creating a Theora video, which is kind of sad. But it's you know, but at least when Google, if Google were to announce VP8, the open source, the open sourcing of VP8 in the I/O conference, everybody is saying they will, then it will probably be accompanied by DirectShow plugins and QuickTime plugins and, you know, stuff for GStreamer and things like that. But of course, that's just the beginning of it. I mean, just offering the plugin to play the stuff, you know, that's relatively easy compared to getting companies that actually make the software used to produce videos, you know, Final Cut and what stuff do you have? I have no idea. I'm not really
Vegas, Sony.
Vegas. Yeah, Vegas, exactly. Those companies have to adopt it too, and that's going to be problematic. But on the other hand, it should technically be easier for VP8 to become part of those packages because of Google's probable involvement with such a project. So,
yeah,
you know, that would be better than Theora. And Theora doesn't really have anyone big standing behind it, like use it, like the MPEG-LA.
Well, Mozilla and Wikipedia, but I don't think that holds much clout with like companies
sorry.
Like Sony.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, crap, you know, we can't avoid this. HP buys Palm.
Oh, that.
Yeah, you shouldn't let that get buried.
They're the one major company which really hasn't gotten into the mobile device game as much as all the others. A lot of other major manufacturers, like, for example, Dell, have gotten into the Android half of things, but HP has been relatively quiet about all of it. There was the Slate, but that was unfortunately canceled, and it was canceled after the purchase of Palm, which makes you go, huh?
Yeah, probably means maybe a WebOS tablet, or maybe not, maybe.
A WebOS tablet would be actually pretty nifty. I polled some people on the internet about that a while ago, asking if they would love to see a WebOS tablet, and the response was overwhelmingly positive. WebOS certainly has a lot more... concreteness than Chrome OS does at the moment.
Yeah. But again, it's still a tablet, and I still don't see a use for a tablet, even if it has WebOS. I just still... But never mind, we already talked about that.
Well, HP have been in, well, give me a get back together. Yeah. HP were in the mobile devices game early on during the PDA craze of the late 90s when it came to competing with
they still
Palm.
Are.
And they've kind of been burnt by Windows Mobile.
But they still ship Windows Mobile phones, by the way.
They do?
Like, you know, with BlackBerry form factor. So, keyboard and display. I've seen a couple of photos of them.
The purchase of Palm could really be them trying to, doing what they should have been doing in a long time, which is having their own operating system for their own devices rather than just being a Windows shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Hewlett Packard has the engineering of all the companies that's got the talent, the engineering, and the prestige to be doing, to be a competitor to Apple in both hardware and software and marrying the two, then, you know, HP is it. And it's been a huge disappointment. I mean, the HP slate is just like the biggest disappointment I think I've ever seen. And axing it is fantastic. It only shows that they've got some sort of commitment to not being Ballmer's lackey.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bowen was pretty pissed off about that one. I mean, he stood there, like, showing that device off, like, earlier this year, and now he kind of looks like like an idiot. Well, he already looked like an idiot, but now he looks even...
Well, wasn't the primary complaint about the slate not so much the hardware, which was HP's half of it, but really the operating system?
Yeah, the software. Yeah, exactly.
And what was it running?
Yeah, Windows 7, exactly. That's what I mean. So. Of course, it had a special layer on top of it written by Hewlett Packard, but, you know, I don't
dress those things up so often. I mean, once you get out of that little tiny protective area, you're going to immediately be thrust into a desktop expecting form factor with a keyboard and a mouse, and you're not going to have as good of an experience as something that's built from the ground up with that intention in mind.
Like the Web OS, so it really makes sense in that regard.
It does. The hardware, I mean, I know Web OS is going to be, in fact, wow, I saw my first Palm Pre a couple of days ago, amazingly, here in the UK.
Jealous. Yeah. I'm jealous.
I just actually spot one in the wild. They're so hard to find. Web OS is would be fantastic for HP Hewlett Packard to be able to put on a tablet. No, it wouldn't be as practical as, say, Windows 7 having the full wealth of Windows software available, etc. But again, the user experience is what matters here. And especially if you're trying to compete on, you know, something as petty as comparison charts with the iPad, which, you know, it's basically the benchmark we've got to go for now, as much as we dislike it. You know, battery life. You cannot have a Windows machine with a running flash going for 2.5 to 5 hours. You know, the iPad says 10 hours. You've got to compete with 10 hours. There's no comparison there. And Windows cannot provide that comparison, nor can Intel hardware provide that comparison at this time.
Yeah, so in that sense, it would make more sense to have an ARM device, Cortex A9 probably, and put WebOS on that thing. That makes a lot more sense. And in the conference call or whatever it's called that followed the NewSwitch acquisition, it became very clear that that's exactly what HP is going to do. I mean, I think they dropped the word tablet like 10 million times.
Palm may have already had these things being, you know, designed and worked on, but had not the cash flow nor the risk to go ahead and do it.
Exactly.
And it always seemed the primary complaint with WebOS devices hasn't been the operating system, it's been the hardware. The Palm Pre and the Pixie, they aren't the best devices in the universe.
Yeah, exactly. And with and I'm sure that Palm would really, you know, Palm knows how to make really good hardware. I mean, just take I have one of those in my closet or somewhere, but I lost the charger here. The tungsten PDAs and everything.
Yeah.
They're built like a brick. It's absolutely, you know, top notch quality hardware. You know, iPhone levels. You know, it's really good stuff. So they know how to do it, but they just don't have the money, and especially not in the past couple of years, they just don't have the money to, you know, produce such, you know, a device like that. But with HP on the side, I mean, with HP money, that's going to be a lot easier. And I'm sure they've had a lot of designs within Palm for really great phones, but they just couldn't afford them. They just couldn't afford to put them into production, and now they can. So, you know, the acquisition will be round off somewhere at the middle of the year, I believe July 31st, if I'm not mistaken. So you could probably see the first devices early next year or something. I don't know how long that something like that would take. I have no knowledge on that.
I would make a bet that we would see something by Christmas.
No, probably, yeah, because of the holiday season, of course. Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah.
What about the fact that HP now has Palm's wealth of patents?
And if that was part of the actual purchasing decision anyway, is Hewlett-Packard really that worried or involved with all of the crap that's going on between Apple and HTC at this moment, and Google, we should add?
I'm not so sure, but at least HP didn't say a whole lot about the intellectual property. While if you looked at the acquisition between RIM and QNX, the whole patent thing, the whole intellectual property thing was, you know, like promptly displayed at the top of the press release, right? And here, not a word, not a single word about it. No, so,
well, that makes sense for Research in Motion. I mean, what's their core market share?
Yeah, okay. That's true. You're right. But it could be, but Croc is also right in that HP doesn't really seem to be involved in that whole lot. But then again, if HP were to start making phones, which is apparently their plan, like phones and tablets, then it doesn't hurt to have, you know, the portfolio from Palm, you know, in your back pocket, right?
Oh, yeah, and to keep quiet about it, I mean, the Palm stuff is very early and predates a lot of stuff, as well as them being, you know, the mainstays in the PDA era, where a lot of these patents would have first started coming up.
Yeah, and in the end, you know, smartphone, PDA, the difference is only that it can do phone stuff. I mean, for the rest, it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, the iPhone, as revolutionary as everybody thinks or deems that it is, it's... You know, it's for me. It's still a completely logical evolution from my Tungsten E2 to my iPhone. You know, it adds the phone capabilities and everything's a little bit smoother and looks a little bit better. But in the end, it's a completely logical evolution for me. So I think most people would call the iPhone revolutionary. I've never actually used something like, you know, a Palm OS device or whatever. But anyway, so it's not a smartphone. Isn't that different from a PDA? So all those patents that Palm has from the PDA era probably still apply to smartphones today. So that's probably a pretty good portfolio to have if you're entering into the phone market, which in the last couple of months has been, you know, overrun with lawsuits between one and the other. So
it's, all of the telephony patents are actually all very well managed and controlled and are licensed as well. Exactly, yeah, which is how Apple managed to enter the market so easily, is that all of that side of stuff is actually, you know, as bad as patents are, that side of things is, thankfully, you know, reasonably well managed.
Yeah, but no, patents in general aren't bad. And I think a lot of the patents surrounding, like, GSM technology and stuff are actually hardware patents, right? And, you know, I don't have any problems with hardware patents. I mean, the investment that it took to create something like GSM, and all the, you know, it's been deployed all around the world. I think it's perfectly reasonable for companies that, you know, partook in that development to earn money from the newcomers today. That's perfectly normal. But I just don't like software patents because they're generally, you know, you can't patent math, right? Let's not get into the discussion right now. But I don't think anything wrong with hardware patents. And if any of the patents that Apple is using to sue HTC are really strictly hardware patents, then I have no problems with those. And if those are, you know, honest hardware patents, then HTC just has to pay up. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But from what we saw from that patent list, like 90%, 99% of those were software patents. So, okay.
No, that sounds great. Okay, Meta. Emails. You can email us at crew@osnews.com. That's C-R-E-W, crew@osnews.com, with any thoughts, and as well as you can comment on the website osnews.com when we publish this podcast. You can follow us on iTunes. Just search for OS News. We actually got a review. Someone rated us.
Wait, on iTunes?
Yes.
Oh. Well, I'm not going to view that because, you know, I'm on Linux, so.
So how bad did we get?
Go find it now.
How many stars did we get? I live for stars. Come on.
It's all negative that matters. Well, they rated us 1, 2, 3, 4. And they rated us 5. The editors of OSNews.com discuss each week's news, tech news, and the articles posted on the website with a special interest in operating systems, and they do a great job of it. Unlike some other technology websites and podcasts, Tom and Croc are unprejudiced and don't focus on any individual system. They have their preferences. Tom frequently takes the opportunity to praise BIOS, But just a quick to point out the drawbacks and mistakes of these systems. Of the 10 or so podcasts I subscribe to, this is one I look forward to most each week. That was September 2009, that's a while ago. But thank you anyway for that.
Yeah, thanks. Whoever it was. Pretty cool.
That's all to
say. Okay, good. Yep. I think we should.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye.